I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When you hear the words war correspondent, what image do you have in your mind? A guy in a flak jacket, crouching down beside a tank, with bullets whizzing over his head. One week he's in Afghanistan, the next he's in Iraq. War today, gone tomorrow. Well, my guest this hour is not that kind of correspondent. Anne Nivat, French-born, Moscow-based, is passionate about what she does and about the people she meets. And she has a special passion for the people of Chechnya, the Russian Republic that's been at war for much of the past decade. She writes not of armoured columns or military strategy, but of individual stories of the people who just try somehow to survive the conflict. But she writes about peace as well as about war, and she's written an intriguing book about some of the people who share her historic apartment block in Moscow. What are the stories that make you connect to the far-off people and the places stuck in war? In the race to have the latest news, are some parts of the world being forgotten? What role do everyday stories have in helping you understand what's going on in the big wide world? You can join our conversation. Call 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Anne, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Being here. Good morning. Now, Chechnya.
Yes.
What is it about Chechnya that has got under your skin?
Well, Chechnya is in my bones. I know it's difficult to understand because I'm, you know, in my book I say I'm neither Russian nor Chechen. This war is not my war. It's just another war, another forgotten war. The thing is, I live in Russia. I speak Russian. I've been fascinated by this country. I have a PhD in Russian affairs. I'm very interested in Russia since, you know, I was a child. And when I settled down in Russia a few years ago, this war started. How could I not go there and report? I was starting as a journalist, and I had the possibility to go down there, so I did. And I was one of the very first journalists to be there. And the thing is, then once you are in, then you are trapped because it's a war and you cannot go out. So I started just, you know, to staying with the people, trying to understand what was the impact of the war for their daily lives. And it was not very difficult to understand because I was one of them.
Okay, that's why you're interested. Why should we be interested?
You should be interested because we live in the same world and because this world is full of wars. And yet, there are people who are like you and me also, who are very happy to be in this part of the world where there is a peaceful part of the world and you have the luxury of, you know, being comfortably seated in your living room and watch the war live on TV, except when there are no TV cameras like in Chechnya. But there are much more people in this world who don't have that luxury. And we better try to understand them, because if we don't, it would get worse and worse. And it is already getting worse, and you know that perfectly. This is about, you know, the terror we are living now.
But you see, there are some wars in which we, the West, are involved. There are others in which we are not directly involved. Chechnya might come into that second category. It's not our war. We are not part of that conflict. There are other things for us to worry about.
But it's not a good reason not to be involved, not to be part of the conflict and not to be interested. Russia, we live in the right after the Cold War, during the Cold War, we lived in a bipolar world. There was the United States of America on one side and on the other side, USSR. USSR was the enemy. Now it's completely different. It all collapsed as far as the USSR is concerned. And we better try to understand what is left for this empire, this communist Soviet empire. Russia is now the big power. But what is Russia? I know we're still trying to answer to the question, who is Mr. Putin? But the real question is, you know, what the relationship between this forgotten war in Russia between the Chechens and the Russians is still going on, and it is, we are not seeing it, we're not watching it on TV because we don't want to see it, because we are having our own little war on terror that we think is justified. So to me, in fact, there is a lot of similarities between what's happening in Russia with its own war and what's happening in this country with the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
If one takes your point that we have a responsibility as human beings who inhabit this planet to be aware of what is happening to other human beings on the same planet, even if it does not directly affect our daily lives, once we have that information, and you provide that information at great risk to yourself, what do you want us to do with the information?
To think a little bit about it. Not to switch the TV channel, you know, and then watch another cartoon or whatever, or advertisement on TV. Just to realize that this is not a movie. This is for real. Then maybe our politicians, because that's their obligation, their duty, should maybe, you know, try to change their behavior, their attitude. And I think just that with more dialogue between the people, whoever they are, we could maybe avoid some of the terrible wars that are going on in this planet.
People listening to you may very well be asking themselves, who is this woman? What kind of a woman is she? She's French, she lives in Moscow, she could be living a perfectly ordinary,
yes,
happy life as a journalist, as something else. You choose to go to a place like Chechnya at huge risk, great discomfort, often very scared. Why?
Because that's the only thing I can do. You're right, I chose that. And other people choose, you know, comfort or whatever. I think I have the deepest respect for anybody. I mean, it's just a question. I am immensely curious about the world. That's why I chose this profession of, you know, being a journalist. And if we journalists don't do that, who is going to do it? Who? Tell me who. That's why, by being in Russia, by speaking Russian, having the possibility to go to Chechnya and report from Chechnya, I just did it. And now that I start, I cannot stop.
It's dangerous what you do. Anybody who covers conflict as a reporter knows it is dangerous. People die. People get hurt. As a woman, is it even more dangerous?
No, I wouldn't say so. It is dangerous for men and women. It is dangerous no matter what. It is immensely dangerous. But for me, that's not a reason enough to... Well, I must say I have been very, very lucky by, you know, surviving the war in Chechnya, for example. And you don't play with luck too much. So I remember when I was first came back to France after the peak of the war, after having covered the peak of the war in 1999-2000 in Chechnya, I'd been often asked about, you know, what could be my next war as a war correspondent. And I'm sorry to say, but I'm not jumping from a war to another war, another one. This is insane. I just happened to cover this war. And yes, it is dangerous, but that's what a real journalist should do.
But you see, you travel on your own, largely, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You are a woman on her own in a foreign land, in countries where, in many cases, a lot of social norms have broken down. People do very unpleasant and nasty things. As a woman, surely you are particularly vulnerable.
Yes, you're right. Yes, I am. And yet I'm the vivid proof of the fact that it is possible. It is doable. So when I hear, you know, other journalists saying, especially TV journalists saying that it is impossible to go to Chechnya because it's too dangerous, it's wrong. They are wrong. It's not true because I did it. But let me tell you something. It's just because I'm not saying that because I did it, everybody should do it. I have a peculiar way of handling that kind of situation. I'm just very much... maybe that's part of my character. I'm not very easily scared, and even less now after having, you know, gone through what I went through. But there are some rules, basic rules, that I think protect me from the danger.
Protect you as a woman?
Well, being a woman, in fact, helps me a lot. Because other women in those Muslim countries, Chechnya is a Muslim country, Afghanistan too, and Iraq too, those three countries where I've been very frequently in the last 2 years. As a woman, I have access to the woman, to the local woman, which a male reporter would not have. So that's, you know, when I stay, because I never stay in hotels. I always stay at the people's house, always. This is part of my method, because I want to gain their trust. I want to be part of their life, at least for a few days. I want to make them share something with me. So I'm with the woman, and when I'm with the woman, I'm one of them. And I gain their respect because of that. And as a woman, foreign woman, I also have the respect of the men, the local men, because I'm not one of their women, I'm a foreign woman.
There must have been many, many occasions when you said to yourself, why do I do this? When you were really scared. Can you just give us one example of an occasion when you really did think that maybe you had gone one step too far?
Oh, well, I have vividly in my mind what I was saying to myself the very first second I was under heavy bombardment in Chechnya. It was in October 99, and I had just crossed the line of the front with a bunch of local Chechens. In a car, inside a car, I was the only woman, and there were like eight men, and they were just covering my. We were just physically really crossing the line. The Russians were installing themselves on this line, but obviously those men with whom I was, the rebels, the Chechen rebels, they really knew what they were doing, and they knew we had time. We had a few seconds to do that, to cross the line and to arrive on their side, on the side of the rebels. And as soon as we did arrive, and I just was out of the car, and we were in this sort of farm. I was surrounded by rebels, very heavily armed. And the Russians started bombing from the air, from the helicopters. And when I saw the first plane, when the plane, you know, just, you know, turned around and started bombing us, and this huge noise that I had never heard in my life, I was, of course, shaking. I could not, you know, I had no saliva anymore. I could not, almost not breathe. And I said to myself, okay, it's not a movie. You are in now. It's too late. You can't move. You just pray that you will survive it, and then you can move on.
But you don't say to yourself, if I get out of this alive, I promise myself I will never do anything so stupid again.
No, I was just hoping that I would, you know, get out alive, and then, because it's too late when you are in the field like that. You cannot think the way you tell me I should be maybe thinking right now. It's impossible because of the adrenaline, because of the fact that you're trapped. So you think differently. You have to acknowledge that you are in it, and it's a question of luck, because, you know, people die in a war. People really die in a war. But you, for example, in this country now, we don't see it. We don't see the coffins coming back. We have, well, we know the numbers more or less, but we don't feel it really. And neither in Russia, because in Russia they're doing the same. They're not showing the coffins.
I'm talking to Anne Nivat, war correspondent and author. What are those stories that make you connect with the people at war, whether they're in Chechnya or Iraq or Afghanistan? Do everyday stories of people and places at war help you to understand better the war and the world? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Robin Lustig. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. We're talking this hour about stories of war and peace. What are the stories that make you connect with people living and surviving in war-torn countries, places often halfway across the world? My guest this hour is the French journalist and writer Anne Nivat. She's based in Moscow. She has spent many years covering the war in Chechnya. She's also reported from Iraq and Afghanistan. And we were talking about what made you scared. Let me ask you about the people you meet. You meet so many people, you pass through their lives, and then you move on. Do you stay in touch with them?
Of course I do, and especially in regards to what you know, Chechnya, for example. I wrote a book about this war in Chechnya, and just recently I wrote a second book about Chechnya, which is not yet translated into English, and I doubt it will be actually, because it's so difficult to convince a publisher. Anyway, that's another discussion, but this is just the proof that. Of course, I'm going nonstop back to Chechnya. And where I'm going? I'm going back to the same families, because I'm in certain families, I became part of the family. So the story now is, you know, who has survived, who has disappeared. So my second book is about me going back to the same places, the same families, and writing about what happened to them. Why? How are they surviving this war?
When you become a part of a family, are you still a journalist?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I'm a journalist anyway. I don't know what I am, because, you know, being a journalist today is so formatted. It's a standard thing. You have to be writing news. You have to be inside this, and I deliberately chose to be different by going by myself to those countries, staying much more time than a normal journalist would stay, because he has no time. He has a deadline and everything, and trying to have a dialogue with those people in order not to get the perfect quote that would fit my story, but just to get something real from them, because I think that's what we miss in the stories.
It's not necessarily though just about time, is it? Because as you know, there is an argument that says part of the role of the reporter is to stand apart, to watch with, as far as possible, a dispassionate eye, to see the picture in the round and then to try to convey that to listeners, to readers, to viewers, whatever it may be. Now, you cast all that aside. You do it quite differently.
But I think I'm quite objective, because look at, the majority of the Western journalists in the war in Iraq, for example. Well, they are now at least acknowledging that they had been a little bit not as objective as they should have been, because they had the wrong sources. We can mention Ahmed Shalabi, who, for example, was the unique source for most of the Washington-based journalists in terms of what is Iraq today. This guy had not been in Iraq for more than 30 years, and he had been used by the CIA, etc. So I'm not sure that he's a very objective source, you know, in terms of information about Iraq, and yet he was the one that was mainly quoted. So I am neither Russian nor Chechen regarding the war in Chechnya. So yes, I do have an empathy for the people I'm staying with, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to be on their side. I'm not doing my job in order to judge anybody.
But you see, you say you sometimes become part of a family. You become part of a Chechen family. You spend time with them. You come to know them, and I suspect even to love them sometimes. But if I were a Russian who had lost a family member in a bombing in Moscow, the responsibility of, quote, Chechen terrorists, unquote. You don't have any friends among them. You don't become
part of the...
You do?
Oh, yes, I do have Chechen friends, and I do have Russian friends. I'm completely in the middle of it. I'm torn. I'm really torn. And I continue. I started going to Chechnya to cover this war in Chechnya because I love Russia, and because I want to understand Russia. Chechnya is part of Russia no matter what, even if they are at war. They have a common past. You see, there is a bond. I mean, they have the 75 years of a communist dictatorship in common. Every Chechen speaks Russian. And basically, most of the Chechen, they don't hate the Russians. They have a lot of good memories.
A lot of Russians hate the Chechens.
Now, because of the war, because of the propaganda from the government about this war, the government claiming that every Chechen is a bandit and a terrorist, but it is far from the nuances of the truth, of the reality.
I suppose what I'm getting at is this idea that there are two sides to every story, there are two sides to every conflict, and one of the reporter's duties is to look at both those sides.
Nobody does that. There is not a single reporter.
People try, don't they?
Well, they try, but everybody has its or her own agenda.
Mm.
by being from the country you are from, you know, by you grew up in a country or you are from, I mean, and I think I don't have any agenda. I'm very good at forgetting who I am, where I'm from, because I've been used to live in many countries. You know, yes, I have a French passport, but I have not lived in France in the last 10 years. I do speak Russian fluently. I am interested per se by, you know, my every people I talk to. I have no agenda. That's why I can. Yes, of course. Let me give you an example. When I was reporting in Chechnya, well, basically I was staying with the people at their places, at their house, and etc. The victims of this war. And yet I was also, I had to interview, it was very interesting for me to try to interview the top rebels, you know, the warlords, and one of them, the number one terrorist, is called Shamil Basayev. He's still alive and he's still in Chechnya, he's still around and he's very much wanted. I met him several times and I interviewed him at his house in Grozny just the day before it was completely bombed by the Russian authorities. But he asked me if I would be happy to stay for a while with him and his warriors for a while, for a week. And, you know, of course, for journalists, it's very tempting to stay with, because I knew that there would have been no other journalist, that this would have been, you know, scoop after scoop and etc. But I didn't do that. I told him, no, I'm not staying with you, Shamil, because I'm just coming to take one interview with you and then I'm leaving. And I might come back in a few weeks if I have, you know, more questions, but I'm not staying with you the same way I'm not staying with the Russians. I'm staying with nobody. I'm just, you know, just going around, staying with the people who are neither rebels nor, you know, the Russian with the Russian army.
I'm talking to Anne Nivat, French journalist. We're talking about Chechnya, about how to cover war. What kind of stories stick in your mind when you read about people and places which are at war? Call us 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And reading your book on Chechnya, I get a very vivid picture of the people that you met, of the places that you stayed, of the dangers that you encountered. I got less of a picture of what this war is about. Was that because you didn't want to try to go into that, that you weren't interested in it? Why was there not?
Because
that
my book are not analytical books. I leave those analyses, would-be analyses, to others, you see. I can tell you what this war is about, but my obsession is with vivid details. I want to, you know, when my reader is reading the book, it's just, he can picture the place. I remember me finishing an article about Grozny, life in Grozny under the bombs at the very beginning of fall 99, and I was filing for Libération at the time, a French daily newspaper. And the last sentence of my piece was the chairs. It was inside a sort of a bar, a cafe in Grozny. And the chairs were in plastic, red plastic. So I wrote, the chairs are, you know, in red plastic. And I received at least 20 letters from readers, you know, telling me how amazing it was that because I had written the chairs are in red plastic, they could picture the scene and the little corner cafe in a war-torn city devastated by the bombs. That's what I want. I don't have a camera with me deliberately. You can imagine. Every French channel asked me to take a camera. I said, no, I don't want, because I'm not a TV journalist. I'm a written press journalist. I do write, I describe everything I see.
Let's take a call. Drew is on the line from Nashville in Tennessee. Hello, Drew.
How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. What are your thoughts? What sticks in your mind when you read these kinds of stories?
Well, what sticks in my mind very much is seeing both sides of the story. And I'm curious as to at what point I heard before talking about the seeing both, starting and trying to report everything objectively and neutral. At what point did you feel that you penetrated that and started to see Chechen civilians more as victims than simply reporting what was going on?
Anne? You see them as victims? Do you report them as victims?
Well, victims, they're obviously victims because they're victims of heavy bombardment. I mean, when you are on the side of, you know, where the bombs are falling, how can you not talk about victims? But this objectivity thing is a little bit, disturbs me a little bit, because first of all, objectivity doesn't exist. Even if you pretend that you report from both sides, it's just your vision of everything. And I don't, I have also a vision of from the Russian side and a vision from the Chechen side. And my take is about is not to be only news obsessed and news orientated. I was not in Chechnya to report about the latest bombing, when it happened, how long did it. I think I bring more to my readers by, you know, conveying what is it about to be under the bombs and how you get used to it and how does it shape your mind.
Drew, do you have a problem with that approach?
Oh, of course not. I absolutely agree that those stories are more compelling. What interested me most was just whether you might go into every situation initially thinking, oh, I'm going to be able to report this, and I'm not going to grow those, to bring those attachments, and to start connecting there. And I'm just curious how quickly that occurred.
I'm very interested that you just used that word attachment. I have a former colleague at the BBC, a very experienced former war correspondent, who developed what he called a theory of the journalism of attachment. He, like you, began to worry that it was impossible to be objective and there were certain circumstances in which it was wrong even to try. And he developed this idea that in certain circumstances in war, and he was talking particularly about Bosnia, the role of the journalist was to attach himself to the experiences of the people among whom he lived. The risk of that, some would say, is that you take sides.
Well, there is always such a risk, but I think it's worth it. It's much better than a very formal style of journalism, because after all, I think you know nothing about the country that is at war when you have been, you know, given only a very dry news about the war, especially when we're talking about wars. I mean, we live in a very dangerous world today, I mean, now, and with this constant issue of terrorism. And I think we better try to understand the roots of terrorism. And this is what I'm doing by reporting the way I do report about wars, which is, you know, being more focused with the human angle. That, to me, is the key to try to not misunderstand those people who are so geographically far from us and yet so close.
Al is on the line from Outer Banks in North Carolina. Al, what are your thoughts?
Well, I feel that this lady, she is so right in what she's talking about, and she's carrying the backbone that's missing from real journalism.
And thank you.
She's so right. She's not neutral, and you can be neutral. There are people who don't think linearly, and they can hold that space of neutrality and love unconditionally and share both sides without going too far or exposing something that's not right. And I think that she's right on it, man, and I think people should really commend her and take some notes. And we should try to understand terrorism. Where does it come from? Why? People just don't do terrorism for fun. It's not fun. There's a reason for it, and we need to ask why, or else it's just going to keep happening, and it's going to get worse.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. And I would like to add something regarding objectivity. U.S. government officials are accusing, for example, the Arab Qatari-based TV station Al Jazeera to be not objective. Of course it is not objective. But do you think Fox News in this country is objective? And even CNN is not objective. It's giving the American perspective take on this war. And I think the same way that CNN is giving an approach, Fox is giving another approach, etc., Al Jazeera is giving another approach, their approach. Everybody has its right, you know, to subjectivity. And then it's our problem. I mean, the viewers, the readers, whoever, to understand what we think is right. Okay, that is the freedom. That is, you know, what means freedom in democracy.
Here's another question for you then, Anne, and it's not an accusation, OK, but it's a question. Where do you draw the line between what you do and propaganda?
Oh, I'm absolutely not doing propaganda. I think propaganda comes from governments. And believe me, the Russian government is extremely good at having propaganda regarding Chechnya, because you see the result. The result is that the outside world think that there is no war in Chechnya, or this war has been forgotten, and that this war is justified. What about the U.S. government propaganda about the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan? What do you know about what's happening in Afghanistan today? I mean, the average American knows nothing about that. What does he know about Iraq? He knows what we see on TV. I mean, where was the last bombings and etc.? I mean, he understands that it's sort of going not very, very well there. But does he know the details? Not really. And all the journalists that have been embedded, you know, this new fashionable thing of being embedded, I think it's also part of the problems, because governments are being very good at trying to impose their vision through us, the journalists. So what I'm trying to do is not to be on their side, of course not, because I don't want to be reporting about what they want me to report.
You did, in fact. I mean, there's an interesting episode in the book where you describe how you did go on one trip to Chechnya with the Russians.
Of course, because that was after the Russian FSB, former KGB, arrested me and questioned me after 9 months of my reporting. And then I accepted to go one time with their government-organized trip in order to show to my readers the difference in coverage.
What was the difference?
Oh, it was huge. It was absolutely huge. When I was for 3 days in this absolutely ridiculous government trip, it was like as if, you know, they were constantly with us 24 hours a day. We could not interview freely anybody. We were like only traveling with military trucks and jeeps. And when I am by myself, I cross any checkpoints, you know, by walking, by foot. I speak with whoever I want.
We're going to take a break. We're talking about stories of war, and we will talk about stories of peace. How do stories of people who live halfway around the world affect you? What are the stories that draw you in and that you remember? In the race for the latest news, is there a risk that some parts of the world simply get forgotten? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the challenges of reporting war and reporting peace, the struggle to connect people who live in peaceful parts of the world with those who don't. My guest is Anne Nivat, a French journalist and writer who is based in Moscow. Anne, we've already spoken about Chechnya and reporting war. You have also written about other things, and you've written a book about where you live in Moscow and about the apartment block and the people who live there. What made you turn from Chechnya to writing about people living in Moscow?
Well, it's very easy. I was fed up with this war, the war in Chechnya. And you know when it was so awful to be coming back from Chechnya, from Grozny, in Moscow, in the Russian capital, and to see how people did not care about this war. And I couldn't talk about it with my friends, even my fellow, you know, the Russian journalists, because until now, they don't understand why I'm going there, because they would not go there. And I just decided to write about something completely different, and I took it easy. I said to myself, well, you live in a fantastic building, one of the seven building built by Stalin in the 50s, skyscraper, they wanted to be competitive with the American skyscrapers, I'm sorry. And I just decided to write about my neighbors.
Now,
initially,
it was
supposed to be a piece for my newspaper, right, and it became a book. Oh. Who are they? Well, it's very interesting. They are former privileged ones under the Soviet Union, such as KGB, former KGB officers, generals, people from the army. This building was built for them, for the people who were the chosen ones by the regime. So, of course, the military people, and also, you know, poets, writers, ballerinas from the Bolshoi Theater, people like that. Of course, because there was no notion of property, private property in Russia, in the Soviet Union, there were some list of people who were allowed to live in this building. And it was like the big thing to be chosen, to be among them. So with the change from the Soviet Union and from this, system to a much liberal system, I just decided to take the alibi of writing about this amazingly unique skyscraper to, in fact, write about the Russians today. Because, again, we have a black and white image of what is Russia and who are the Russians. I mean, we hear constant talks about the prostitutes, the oligarchs, vodka problems, alcoholics, children in the street, etc., etc. And that's not all Russia is. Of course, again, I'm going into the nuances of, you know, of who those people are.
We don't have time for you to introduce us to all of your neighbours, but just introduce us to one of them.
Well, for example, this woman, 35-year-old Yelena, who is the last chapter of the book and who grew up as a very poor child, and she went to university because it was easy, you know, under the Soviet Union. Everything was for free, of course. And she became, in the first year of the post-Soviet Russia, she's now very, very rich because she launched a big agency for bodyguards, a security agency, which is very needed in Russia today. And she's the only woman in this business. So she is in this building, and she bought two apartments in the building that she connected to each other. And she told me that when she was a child, she was just walking around, you know, the embankment where the building is built, and she could not even dream about leaving this building one day because she knew it was for the privileged ones. It just shows that now the fact that you can buy an apartment in the building because there is private property changed everything.
We're going to take another call. This one comes from Japan. Mara is on the line from Iwakuni. Mara, hello.
Hello. Good evening, at least from where I sit.
Good evening.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest, whether she has ever been in a position where she's come across information that if she shared it with the other side, a lot of lives would be saved. And whether she's been in that conflict. And I could take my comments off the air.
Good question. Anne, a situation where you have information which, if you were to share it, could have saved lives?
Well, I'm not sure. It reminds me of a situation when I was in a village near Grozny, the Chechen capital, and I happened to be in this village by pure chance, again, luck, hazard. And the very morning I was there, a bunch of rebels arrived from Grozny, more than 1,000 of them. And I didn't understand at this very moment what was happening, but in fact it was the turning point of the war. It was just all the rebels were leaving Grozny, the capital. They were leaving Grozny, literally leaving, physically leaving Grozny. So the Russians entered Grozny and pretended that they won this war. But anyway, this very moment when it was very confusing what was happening, I was the only journalist in this village. And among them was Shamil Basayev, this number one terrorist, according to the Russians. And I knew he was there because I saw him physically. I didn't know what to do. I called my newspaper in order to file a story, of course. But I told my newspaper not to publish the story immediately because if it would have been in the newspaper that, or in the wire service, that the top rebel was in this place, I mean, the Russians could have bombed immediately in order to kill him. Because obviously the Russians were looking for him. And I decided not to give this information in order to save the lives of the people in this village.
And his life.
And his life. And he left.
Did that make
and
you,
my life.
Did that make you complicit in his cause?
Well, I'm not sure because, you know, I you never have all the information you should do in order to realize if you are part of something, how actively you are part of it. Maybe the Russians knew where he was and they deliberately decide not to bomb this village immediately at that certain moment. Because, I mean, I cannot tell you now, it would be too long, but they did bomb this village where the rebels were a few hours later. Shamil Basayev had just left, but I was still there, and a bunch of more than a few thousand other rebels were still there, and this was the most horrifying days in my life.
Can we just move away from Chechnya for one second? Because I know you've reported from Iraq and from Afghanistan. As you've said, other Muslim countries, other countries which have been through war. What strikes you more, the similarities or the differences?
Similarities. I decided to go to Afghanistan and Iraq after, of course, September 11th, when I realized that this was the issue, that those war that had been, you know, what happened on September 11th was so terrifying, and it was provoking new wars. When I decided not to be part of the crowds of journalists who immediately went to Afghanistan, because again, I am either before the crowd or after the war, the crowd, because that's what where I feel more at ease in order to understand a little bit with less, you know, adrenaline what's going on. And so in Iraq and in Afghanistan, I was not there during the attacks, but I am just back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And believe me, I mean, the wars in both countries are far from being over. But the similarities are that, for example, people in Iraq today are completely lost. And that's something that we better understand now, because they have lost everything. They have lost their values. They have lost their principles. Of course, they are very happy not to have Saddam Hussein anymore. But they are immediately, you know, when you speak to them, you immediately understand that for them, that's not enough, because they are sort of nostalgic, not of Saddam Hussein himself, the way the Russians are not nostalgic of, you know, communism and the communist dictatorship. They are nostalgic of the safety of this life they had under the dictator. And they are not sure about what is to come.
I want to say something too, which may sound very brutal and unfeeling, and I apologise if it does. But some people listening to you might be thinking to themselves, what Anne is actually saying to us is that in war, people suffer and people die. We knew that.
We maybe knew that, but we behave as if we don't. Especially in the news industry, the media industry, and the politicians. War is not a game. It's not a computer game. It's for real. And we should really understand that when we start a war, it's going to be very difficult to stop, because it's non-stop suffering. And by pretending that wars are over when they are not, we are fueling terrorism.
Does that turn you into a pacifist? Does that lead you to a position which says all war is wrong?
Well, of course I am a pacifist, because I am myself, I went through a war. You know, before going to Chechnya, I had no idea what is a war. I had read, you know, about wars, the Second World War, I mean, in my at school, and I heard my grandmother speaking about the war. but I had no idea about how dirty it is and how it can be used, you know, to impose a political agenda. And well, and of course I understand that it's in the Russian government's interest to pretend that the war in Chechnya is justified, the same way it's in the U.S. government interest to pretend that the Iraq war is justified. But look at where we are now. When I hear officials in this country, the U.S. president, saying that we live in a safer world now, what a mistake. This I think this would make anybody a pacifist, because this is just untrue.
Is there a limit to how much war you can report? You spoke about writing your book about your apartment block because you needed to do something different. Is there a point at which you will say, I just can't do this anymore, I've seen enough?
Well, that's what I'm thinking now about Chechnya. I think I can't do it anymore. I said to my publisher, there won't be a third book on Chechnya. That's it. I'm done. It doesn't mean that I won't go back and keep going back to Chechnya, because I'm bound to this place and because I have so many people I know. And I told them, this is sort of my way of, you know, showing them my respect. As far as the war is not over, I will be coming back and coming back and coming back. I have never seen Chechnya without a war. I am dying to see it, you know, when it will be a peaceful country. Because it's, but I think I went to Iraq and to Afghanistan because that's what is in the news. We ought to know what's going on there.
And after all of the writing that you've done, all of the dangers that you've encountered and the difficult days and nights that you have spent, do you believe that you have changed anything?
No, I've changed nothing. I can't change a thing. I mean, politicians have the upper word. They are the ones who can start real dialogues and try to reestablish trust, which I think are, you know, critical, especially in this context. I think I've done the very small part I can do, which is just to try help my readers, the ones who want to know about it, to understand a little bit more in details and more vividly who they are. And by they, I mean all those we are fighting. Because I am just convinced that by understanding each other, we will just get closer. And this is, you know, I'm just building bridges. I am an intermediary. I'm nothing more, nothing less. This is what I think journalism is about. And I don't think I'm taking sides. I think I am just trying to do my best to convey something real, sincere, authentic to my reader who wants to know it.
Anne Nivat, many thanks for spending time with us on The Connection today. Anne
Thank
Nivat
you.
Is an author, a journalist. Her books include Chien de Guerre, a woman reporter behind the lines of the war in Chechnya. And she is, as she told us, currently finishing a book on Iraq and Afghanistan. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Orit Kuritsky-Fox, Kelly Jones, Jen Matson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo and Doug Shugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection.